I call the meeting of the Energy Committee on Energy and Finance and Policy to order. We have a quorum. Our first item of business is the approval of the minutes. Yes, Madam, Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to real quick ask a question about expectations for hearing notices, and wanted to better understand what day things, when things will be noticed. I think we've always had the 3-day rule. Mm-hmm. And so, say, for example, last year on a Tuesday hearing, we noticed it on Thursday. And I think this week, things didn't get noticed until Friday. And I think we have never counted the weekend. So just wondering if that's going to be the practice going forward, just wanting to better understand expectations about notifying for bill or for hearings.
Certainly, Madam Chair. That is our goal, is to give as much advance notice for committee hearings as possible, and bill hearings as well. And so our goal will be to, generally, sometimes they've considered Sunday as a day, but our goal is to not count Sundays as much as possible moving forward.
But I'm hearing you say you count Saturdays?
I believe we do, yes, Madam Chair, Representative Akam.
I will just say in the past we haven't, and we've taken business days, and so just maybe offer that just to ensure people have, not everybody is around the Capitol as much, and to give them as much time to be able to come and participate if they so choose, but just offering a little feedback.
Sounds good. Thank you. Representative Akam, I appreciate the feedback. We'll take that into consideration as much as possibly can. So thank you. So our first item of business, approval of the minutes. May I have a motion for the minutes of February 20th? Representative Mecklen moves approval of the minutes for February 20th, 2025. Is there any discussion? Representative Kraft.
I just want to comment to you on how much Senator Mecklen's voice sounded like yours. It's great.
Thank you.
Well, just for clarification, I would like to move the minutes.
That's right. Thank you, Representative Mecklen. Thank you, Representative Kraft. We appreciate that. Any other discussion on the approval of the minutes from February 2025? Hearing none, those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes from February 20th are approved. Next, on our item of business, we have two bills we'll be hearing today, House File 249, Representative Igo. Representative Igo moves that House File 249 be placed on the General Register. Representative Igo, I believe you have an author's amendment if you'd like to get the bill in the shape that you would like it and explain your amendment and to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I do have a quick author's amendment to get the bill in the shape I'd like for presentation today. The author's amendment just strikes line 1.10 out and replaces it. We just got rid of that 50% line. It cleans the bill up, makes it easier to understand. So that is my motion. If we could adopt that amendment, please.
All right. Any discussion to Representative Igo's author's amendment? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. Rep. Igo, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 249 is actually a pretty simple bill. It's getting at the carbon-free definition. So as we were talking through 2040 last year, we wanted to make sure that we are practicing an all-of-the-above energy approach to make sure that Minnesotans have access to safe, reliable, and affordable energy. So one of the things that Minnesota has that's part of our legacy industry is a vibrant and active timber industry. And in that timber industry, we produce lots of byproducts, whether that be slash, whether that be wood chips, whether that be sawmill dust. And right now, the only places that those things sit is in the yards, or they're paying tipping fees in our landfills. And not even just for those. Emerald ash borer, I know we've talked a lot about environment and even spilled into this committee a little bit. It's something that is a problem, not only here in the Twin Cities metro, but in greater Minnesota. We have no valuable markets for this residual wood waste to go besides going into landfills, where it is being put into a landfill to rot and emit carbon, or it's being laid down in our forests, which produce fire hazard and even more hazards for insects and blight. So what this bill is going to do today is it would make carbon-free technologies apply to limbs, branches, and other byproducts of timber harvesting operations conducted to obtain wood for non-energy purposes. And that's a really important line in there, members, because I wanted to make sure it was very clear that We aren't going to be going out into our forests in Minnesota and clear-cutting them to produce energy, and nor would that ever happen. I know I've got some testifiers today who would talk about how valuable our timber industry is, and we're not going to see good cordwood being put into facilities for use to produce energy. And the other line that I put in there is discarded wood products, so that instead of bringing discarded wood products to landfills, they could go to facilities where we could create renewable carbon-free power and utilizing the lifespan of wood products. It's our greatest natural resource. You know, there's an interesting study I read once, you know, when we're just talking about how rare diamonds and gold are. But in reality, one of the rarest resources we have is wood products, because we don't know of anywhere else in the galaxy or in the world that they've been created yet besides right here. So let's utilize Minnesota in what we have in front of us with a vibrant timber industry. What's something we've been doing for a long time here in the state. We do it better than anywhere else. We manage our forests. Let's help create this market and give Minnesotans more affordable, reliable, and safe energy solutions to bring those costs down. So with me, I do have some testifiers today that are going to help tell that story, and I think we can move on to that then, unless there's any questions to start.
Any questions for Representative Igoe? All right. Can we have Ray Higgins from Minnesota Timber Producers Association? If you'd like to introduce yourself to the committee, and you can go on with your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Ray Higgins of the Minnesota Timber Producers Association. We're a trade organization representing loggers, truckers, sawmills, and allied businesses in our state's forest products industry. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 249. Designated this renewable woody biomass as carbon-free will help our state achieve its climate goals. It'll allow and encourage utilities to make significant investments in converting coal-fired power plants to instead use forest residues like tops and limbs, as well as dead and dying non-merchantable timber. Keep in mind that carbon from forest biomass generated from management is already being emitted right now, either through decay or as fuel for wildfires. The tops and limbs we're talking about are currently on the forest floor, already decaying, emitting all of their carbon either this year or next. The good news is our forests are dynamic and can do more than one thing at a time. While some of this material is decaying and emitting carbon, Minnesota's healthy forests are simultaneously absorbing carbon. And because annual growth exceeds mortality by more than 3 times, that's a lot of carbon we're absorbing in our forests. It's important to focus on the biogenic life cycle and on studies conducted here in Minnesota and not done elsewhere, where the composition of the forest is different. For instance, studying this topic in Washington or Oregon, where different tree species grow, like redwoods or sequoias, something like that, they grow for centuries, have longer life cycles. That's not pertinent to what happens here in Minnesota. The lifespans of the various tree species in our state are significantly different. Researchers here in Minnesota say that Minnesota forests are significant carbon sinks, and it's not even close. Other states, like Colorado, have significant forest carbon emitters, and that's because they've got a lot more dead material on the forest floor than what we have. We have nice and healthy forests. Just last month, the Minnesota Forest Resources Council, a 17-member body created to advise the governor and legislature on forest policy, released a first-of-its-kind study examining carbon storage and emissions in our state's forestry sector. The study's findings are consistent with the efforts to utilize this material in energy generation. In short, using forest residue as outlined in House File 249 will only further the ongoing efforts in our state to keep our forests healthy. I thank Representative Igoe for bringing this bill forward. He's a true friend of healthy forests, and I urge your support. And before I want to say one last thing. The next two testifiers won't say this about themselves, but Rod Enberg and Tom McCabe are former Minnesota Loggers of the Year. They've been doing this for a long time. To be Logger of the Year, you're recognized by the State Sustainable Forestry Initiative Committee as examples of the best forest management, sustainable forest management our state has to offer. So these two gentlemen wouldn't say that about themselves, so I'll say it for them. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Just a quick question, Mr. Higgins. Would you consider part of a carbon sequestration, so to speak, when it comes to the utilization of a tree, like a 2x4 or a beam, is that a form of storage as well?
Absolutely. Mr. Chair and members, absolutely. I was admiring this right here as I was sitting over here. Wood products are 50% carbon by weight. So all the woodwork we see in this room, or the 2x4 that you mentioned, storing carbon right now. So when you make a forest product like a 2x4 or any of the beautiful woodwork we have in this room, that's storing carbon.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifier? All right, if you'd stick around just in case someone thinks something up,
I'll
certainly
close.
Appreciate it. Thank you. All right, Tom McCabe with the McCabe Forest Products. It sounds like you might be a Forester of the Year as well. So,
Logger of the Year.
Logger of the Year, sorry. If you'd want to introduce yourself to the committee, and welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Tom McCabe. I own a logging and trucking business in Duluth, Minnesota. Been in business for about 50 years. A big part of my business has been producing and selling woody biomass. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 249. The biomass my company produces is mainly tops and limbs that are the result of a timber harvest. We deliver the roundwood to make paper, lumber, or other wood products. We feed the tops and limbs into a chipper to make biomass and ship it to places that use it for energy, like Minnesota Power in Duluth or Hibbing Public Utilities. Having markets for this biomass is critical to the success of my business and many others in our state. Profit margins in our industry are incredibly tight. Being able to market and sell biomass makes my business more profitable and allows us to further manage forests and make the wood products we all use every day. Removing some biomass helps reduce the fire danger and improves forest health in our state. To be sure, leaving some biomass behind on a harvest site is helpful for regeneration, soils, and other forest values. When we handle this material, all businesses in Minnesota follow biomass harvesting guidelines that were created by the Minnesota Forest Resource Council. These guidelines are best management practices and ensure that we do our work sustainably. Clarifying woody biomass is carbon-free, and adding sources such as tops, limbs, and branches to this definition, as provided in House File 249, will encourage utilities to use this material in energy generation. It will help our state reduce carbon in the atmosphere and also help achieve our state's climate goals. House File 249 helps small businesses like mine all throughout Minnesota and gives a boost to our rural economies. I urge your support of House File 249. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McCabe. Are there any questions? All right, thank you. Next, we have Rod Edinburgh from Edinburgh Logging. If you'd want to introduce yourself to the committee, and welcome to the committees.
Mr. Chair and members, Rod Edinburgh from Motley, Minnesota. I don't have a lot of information that I'm going to wing, so I'm going to wing it here a little bit. I'll look back when I started logging back in like 1971 and 72, I started into it. Our timber permits were really kind of strange at the time. The species that we were harvesting was mainly aspen and oak. The maple, the birch, the ash, all of the alternate species that was on our sale, we were required to cut it and let it lay on the ground. We could not leave it there. If we did, why then we got fined to do that. So essentially what we were doing, we were wasting many, many tons of wood, not only with no market for it. So we fast forward a little, and then our requirements changed, of course, and then biomass was always difficult to get rid of, so we never really embraced it until the power plant in Benson started up, where they were actually blending turkey litter with our wood chips. That was really, really a godsend for us in the timber harvesting business, because we had our resource readily available, which was our tops, limbs, our alternate species that we would leave in the woods. All of a sudden, we had a market for it. And it was a good market. It fluctuated up and down. But there again, we were not carbon neutral or classified as that at the time. And there was an awful lot of, pointing fingers on why the Benson power plant went down. But if we would have had a carbon neutral classification at the time, maybe things could have changed and looked a little better, and our business would have continued to go on. And not only myself on that closing, we were generating a very large amount of money for our little town, which is about $5 million a year. Well, your ancillary spinoff from that was pretty nice for our local economy. Not only my business was impacted by that, but Representative Weiner. He was delivering product and biomass to Benson at the same time. So, you know, he is well aware of what the ramifications of that was when we lost that market. Now, a story of hope that kind of got dashed as I was driving down here. An engineer 2 weeks ago called me about the possibility of biomass utilization at a recycling paper product plant in the Becker area. I called him today to see how that was going. Well, they torpedoed it basically to use natural gas and propane, which is an expensive way to make their product, but if it would have been a carbon neutral classification for our biomass products and chips, would that have made a difference on the decision whether they would have went on this plant? Possibly another market that we need desperately for our biomass and woody debris. So now I'll step on to a, if I, can I talk a little bit, to a real success story. I'm a partner at American Peat Technology in Aiken, Minnesota. All right, when we started that business, we were burning propane. And we process peat, and it the product that we make is an inoculant that goes international, and it grew and it grew and it grew, and our business was really, really struggling for energy costs because we were committed to propane because we're remotely located. So we decided to go with burning chips. And by burning chips, we spent about $1.25 million the first year to put in our chip burning system. It paid for itself in the first 3 years, and our business has grown now so that we're employing 42 people there full-time, good jobs, great success story for the biomass industry. Now, if we were carbon neutral, would that help us as far as being able to market our product more internationally, that we can claim it as a carbon neutral product that we're producing with biomass, a label that in some businesses is very important. So as I stop talking, I guess the three stories of woe, hope, and success, if we can get more industries in this state that would embrace the use of biomass and use it and capitalize on the carbon neutral classification for whatever it be, for marketing or tax incentives, it would be a really a great thing. And I appreciate Senator Igoe for bringing this to the
Mr. Enberg, he's don't do that to him.
But,
I'm just teasing. He's a rat. Right. No, I'm just teasing.
Okay. All right. I'm done.
Thank you. No, you're doing good. We're just having fun. So,
what did you say?
Any questions? We don't want any demotions happening at the front desk. So. All right. Are there any questions? All right. Thank you. All right. Rick Horton with Minnesota Forest Industries. Come to the table and identify yourself, and welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and committee members, how do you follow that, right? Nothing like getting the citizens up here to speak. My name is Rick Horton. I'm the Executive Vice President of Minnesota Forest Industries. We're a trade association representing the primary wood-consuming mills in the state, so the big paper mills, big sawmills, and that sort of thing. Woody biomass energy production can provide reliable, dispatchable baseload power from a source that is renewable and sustainable. That's a key point. You know, we, the big industries, need reliable energy. We need safe energy. You can't just shut down a paper mill. You can't just shut down an iron mine. It destroys equipment, and it's really unsafe for the workers. So it is important to have this baseload power as we work on energy transition, right? Energy production from woody biomass is carbon neutral. Atmospheric carbon is absorbed by trees. If you were to design a piece of equipment that could do this, you'd be a rich man. but a tree just sucks carbon right out of the atmosphere and turns it into wood. We turn that wood into products that all of us use every single day. If we were not even there, it would still be in that closed loop. The tree absorbs it, the tree eventually dies or burns up, and the carbon is released back. More trees absorb it. It's a closed loop. Far better than taking fossil carbon that's been in the ground for billions of years and releasing that into the atmosphere, right? So it's a case of, you know, if not this, what, to get that baseload, that reliable baseload power. And creating a use for this material is very beneficial for the forest itself. We've got over 700,000 acres of dead and dying balsam fir in northeastern Minnesota from the spruce budworm. We've got emerald ash borers killed most of the ash trees in the metropolitan area and is creeping north. And if it ever gets into our black ash stands, we're going to see a billion cords of dead trees, a million acres of dead trees. We've also got a million acres of dead and dying tamarack from eastern larch beetle. These are all species we don't have a lot of markets for. And so having this tool to help us manage forest health would be amazing, right? You know, and we also go to great lengths to protect natural resources. There was a time, you know, at the, you know, way back when we were unsustainable. We know we harvested trees and then didn't think of the future. We have dramatically changed that in the last 150 years. We are all about sustainability. We have site-level guidelines in place to ensure that we're protecting the soil, we're protecting the water, cultural resources, recreational, scenic vistas. We have third-party certification entities that set standards and guidelines that we follow, and we are audited annually to make sure we're following those guidelines to ensure that we are ecologically, socially, and economically sustainable. Now, we are the fifth largest industry in the state. We provide good-paying jobs and support rural communities across northern Minnesota. And the development of biomass-based energy production will strengthen the industry and provide more employment for folks like Rod and Tom that you heard here. And I will say that industrial electricity rates are already very high in Minnesota. You know, we have competitiveness studies where we looked at industrial electricity rates in competing states. And we exceeded Wisconsin. It's one of the few things we shouldn't be too proud of here, but we exceeded Wisconsin in 2018, and our industrial energy rates are the highest among competing states. And so as we look at this carbon-free by 2040 bill and its implications and worry about what that's going to mean for cost, this is one way we can keep those costs in check and still have that reliability and that safety that we all require. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Horton. Are there any questions? Is that Representative Meckland?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure I want to clarify with you, Mr. Horton. If a tree, all these tops, the branches, all that, if it's just left to decay, does that carbon then end up back in the atmosphere?
Mr. Horton.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it takes time for trees to break down, but it's faster than people would realize. We have a very wet environment. And so, yes, when there's decay, a lot of it goes back into the atmosphere as part of the decay process. Some of it goes into the soil as part of the decay process and goes into leaf litter for a while and then into these other pools. But eventually the lion's share of it goes back into the atmosphere.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Mekla?
No.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I want to thank all the testifiers. Like we were talking about forestry. It's a really important service that you all provide. I do want to dig into a couple things. On the decaying and going back into the atmosphere, I've looked it up. I think it takes tens of years, probably 40 to 70, depending on the environment. Sound reasonable to you?
For all of it, Mr. Chair and committee member, yes. For all of it, I've seen estimates of that. And it all depends on the type of tree. You know, like an oak decays a lot slower, a maple decays a lot slower than, say, a pine tree or an aspen tree.
Correct. And
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the other side of this is when folks are talking about wood, they all talk about that you can grow a new tree and that can absorb carbon. But if you're replacing a tree that's lost or that's fell down, that also is probably talking about taking tens of years at least, correct, to absorb the same amount of carbon from your understanding?
Mr. Horton.
Mr. Chair and Representative. So a young tree absorbs carbon at three times the rate of an old tree. If you ever look at old growth, true old growth wood, which is hard to come by, you'll notice the rings are very close together because they really aren't absorbing a whole lot of carbon anymore. They're storing it, you know. But if we take that tree and we turn it into wood products, we can substitute for other things that are more carbon intensive in construction. That would be concrete and steel, right? So that's a whole nother factor. But yes, the forest, the young forest takes a while to get back to that same amount of storage. But if we look at carbon on 100-year cycles and across the landscape, we have far more trees dying of old age insects and disease in Minnesota than we cut down every year. We only cut 1% of the forest every year.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So tens to hundreds of years. I'm just trying to establish a baseline. I said, I think the stuff that you all do in clearing out is a really important service. I'm just trying to make sure we agree on timelines, and I'll come back later with further discussion. Thanks.
Sounds good. All right, thank you. Any other questions? All right, thank you, Mr. Hansen. Sarah Meridian, you want to come to the table and introduce yourself? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Swedenski and committee members. As you have heard over the last couple of weeks, you are familiar with me, but my name is Sarah Meridian, and I'm the Government Relations and Policy Director for CURE. We're a rurally based nonprofit dedicated to protecting and restoring resilient towns and landscapes by harnessing the power of the people who care about them. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in opposition to the House File 249 today. As you all know, in 2023, the legislature passed the 100% carbon-free law. The law explicitly states that carbon-free means a technology that generates electricity without emitting carbon dioxide. That language is not ambiguous. It is crystal clear. If a technology emits carbon dioxide in the process of generating electricity, it is not carbon-free. Despite this, House File 249 seeks to defy logic and science by declaring that carbon-free includes a method that, by its very nature, emits carbon. In comments to the Public Utilities Commission about how the Commission should interpret the unambiguous carbon-free, even the Minnesota Forest Industries, who we just heard from, acknowledged the reality that CO2 is emitted when burning woody material. The irrefutable fact is that the combustion of wood chips or any biomass wood feedstock emits carbon dioxide. Beyond this, there are additional concerns that come with burning biomass. First, despite arguments that biomass is carbon neutral, the reality is much more complex, and ample research has shown that the life cycle emissions of CO2 for forest biomass is often worse than the same amount for energy generated by fossil fuels, accounting for feedstock, the fossil fuel replaced, and the efficiency of combustion. Additionally, detailed analyses have shown that biomass plants can emit greater amounts of other pollutants, including nitrogen oxides, volatile organic compounds, particulate matter, and carbon monoxide, than coal plants generating the same amount of energy. That this bill includes the catch-all discarded wood products is especially concerning, as this could allow for the combustion of treated lumber, such as creosote rail ties, and other contaminated wood products, which produce additional toxic air pollutants. For these reasons, CURE encourages you to reject this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? All right. Those are the folks that have called ahead to testify on House File 249. Do we have any folks from the public that would like to testify? Anyone? Member discussion. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Igo, thanks for bringing this bill. Some of the testifiers said that wood is renewable and sustainable, and I don't think I would disagree with that on the right time frame, and then also said carbon neutral. But what I want to talk about is on what time scale can you consider something to be carbon neutral? And I think based on the questions that I had with one of your testifiers, that we're talking really probably something on the order of 30, 50, 70 years. Would you agree with me?
Representative Igo.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kraft, so I think when we're looking at the time scale here, you can understand the way that we grow and harvest mm-hmm. our forests in Minnesota. So, yeah, when we're cutting down a stand of 60-year-old popple, and I know my timber producer friends over here, those are hard to come by. That's good wood. But on the, usually it's lesser in age than that. And it, in that whole lifespan, it's been sequestering carbon, storing carbon, taking it out of the atmosphere, cleaning it up. And then what we're talking about here is what's left behind when we take that wood to market. So just the limbs and the branches. So in that time span, because we're not, it is sequestered more than it's going to emit when it is burned, which hence is making it carbon neutral.
Representative Kraft.
Mr. Chair, it's sequestering, Representative Igo, it's sequestering more. I don't know that I fully understand that. But here's the real concern I have with this. I think it very often may very be a good thing for us to be having some productive use with waste wood, right? We have a lot of issues with emerald ash borer, the other things. So I think that's not a bad thing to do that. What I object to is it's fundamentally not carbon neutral when it's happening. And let me just give you a thought here. If it takes 20, 30, 40, 50 years to be carbon neutral, at that, let's say 40 years from now, that's 2065. If we continue on our current path of carbon emissions, we will without change in the world, we'll probably be at close to 3 degrees increase in temperature compared to pre-industrial times. We can't do that. We're barely at, not even at 1.5 right now. We're seeing incredible extreme weather and impacts and forest fires and all kinds of things. So that world is not a world that we want our kids and grandkids to live in. So I think we have to be really careful with counting. And one of the testifiers spoke about that designating this as carbon neutral would be a marketing benefit. I agree. I'm sure it would be, but it wouldn't be counting the carbon emissions that are happening when wood is burned in the right way. So I will say, I think it is a reasonable thing to do, but let's not confuse that this is a path for that we might want to use for some of this waste wood and things with something that is carbon neutral on a time frame that matters. So that's all I would say is, I can see why, but let's not bastardize the approach of what carbon neutral is from a marketing perspective. Thanks.
Representative Kraft, was that more of a comment than a question?
Mr. Chair, I think it was.
Okay, sounds good. All right, thank you, Representative Kraft. Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Igo, for bringing this to our committee and for an opportunity to talk about this. I'm actually excited to dig into this issue. I always come back to what is the issue or the problem that we're trying to solve, and from what I've kind of been gathering, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like the issue is more about finding a market for our forest products. Can you help me confirm if that's the problem?
Representative Igo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jones. So yes, it's creating a market, but it's also trying to help eliminate waste, right? In the Twin Cities metro here alone, 10 to 12 truckloads of emerald ash borer are being brought to our landfills and paying tipping fees, or they're just being put in landfills to rot and emit carbon. We have nowhere else for those to go. If you go across our state and see a lot of our other mills that have, you know, whatever they're producing, have slash piles that just sit there and rot because there is no markets for them because we don't have legislation like this on the books. So there is no market to be created for them. So what this bill is trying to do today is to create a market for them while also getting at the science of the fact of what these things are. So we're not just going to continue to emit carbon for no reason because it's going to get emitted somewhere or another.
Mm-hmm. Representative Jones.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Igo. It's helpful. I also agree. I don't want waste. I think a lot of us, or most of us, want to make sure that we're avoiding waste. And so, I guess one of the things that I'm struggling with is, so I've worked in energy for a while. Also, my husband and I, we ran a commercial composting facility at one point, and at that time, our biggest struggle was actually carbonaceous, so carbon material. And so I'm wondering if there's maybe a disconnect in that kind of arena because we have a lot of food waste, but we actually don't have enough carbon material. So I think that's maybe an opportunity that we maybe don't need to create policy around. The other piece is, does this, Are we precluded in any way from using our woody waste for heating at the moment?
Representative Igo.
I probably want to have one of my testifiers respond to that. I mean, where I'm from and where I live and where some members of this committee live, we have, you know, many of my constituents heat their homes with wood right now and wood boilers. That is correct. Mm-hmm. That's a whole nother discussion, though, if you want to get into that, about some of the rules and regulations that have been coming out behind that, making that more expensive and harder to do. I don't know if that necessarily pertains to what we're getting at here in the bill today, though.
Okay. Representative Jones?
Yeah, just maybe one last thing on that. Yeah, just the other space that I've been seeing a lot of woody biomass used is at the St. Paul District Energy Plant, I think also in Duluth. And so, and I've again, in my conversations, I've been hearing it's like, well, at one point or some point, we're going to run out of the emerald ash borer, you know, infected trees. And so we're going to need more of that or more wood in order to fuel that plant. So just maybe trying to connect some dots because I think there is some opportunity. And so, I think similar to Representative Kraft, I'm not on board with calling this carbon free, but I think there are some markets, and I'm happy to continue a conversation about identifying what are the markets so we can make sure that this really important product is put to good use.
Representative Igo? Good. All right. Representative Acom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for the discussion today. I think we've had this discussion with Representative Igo a couple of times over the years, and so I appreciate the chance to talk about it again. And while I don't have a question, I have more just a comment, and that is really the heart of the issue for me is on line 1.8 of the bill, that generates electricity, the definition of carbon-free, generating electricity without emitting carbon. And biomass does not fit into that bucket. And so while I appreciate that energy can be generated in that way, I think it can't be called carbon-free if it is. And so I think we've talked about other ways, whether it's district heating that it can be utilized in. I think that there are some concerns I also have about additional emissions that come with transporting, processing, and the like of biomass that add to the life cycle. So all in all, I would encourage my members to vote no on the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Any other discussion? All right. Representative Wiener.
Thank you for bringing this bill forward. And I think the testifiers did a good job of explaining the process at the beginning. If you go out to a forest, you don't get to utilize all of the material. Trees have crook, they have bend, they have knots, they have other things that you just can't use. The branches are just part of it. But my experience in moving forward is everything that we do or that we kind of deal with in our society has moved on a wood product at some point in time or another. Your shipping almost always goes on pallets. We have a housing shortage in our state, which that material can come from the sawmills that we're talking about. And when you take that round log and you cut off the edges, you make slabs. That slabs is waste. Those sawmills produce a lot of material that cannot be utilized for another product. If you take a semi-load of logs, you put it on a log deck, and I've got some experience with this, your usable material can be anywhere from 50 to less percent of those logs that came in. So all of that extra material has to find a place to go with, or two. So if you want to fix the housing shortage in the state of Minnesota, you also have to look at the waste that's there in the production. The trusses that go into that house have to be trimmed. The boards have to be made. They have to be planed down. So there's sawdust. There's trim pieces. I can tell you that truss manufacturers in our area can produce semi-loads a day of waste material. This bill gives the opportunity to take that material from the start to the finish and give it a place to go. We talked about the Emerald Ashboard. That's a small portion of the resources that are out there. It was staggering when I first started learning about this, how much waste, unusable material. I won't call it waste, because it is usable in one form or another. To turn it into energy is a very viable option. And when we look at everything that we can do and everything that it touches in our lives, like I said, your cabinets is something that's going to be made out of those woods just grown here in Minnesota. Trusses, pallets that everything ships on, the brush from our landscaping companies across the metro, all of that is a usable product in another source. And whether it's carbon in the air from decaying material or the industries themselves, California has different biomass burners now. I think Michigan has put up another one. Other states are saying that this is a usable product, and it meets those standards. I think we're selling ourselves short, our opportunity short, our industry short in the state by not adding this. Thank you for bringing this forward.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So briefly, Representative Wiener, I want to be really clear for myself. I'm not arguing that there shouldn't be a use for these things and that there's not some good uses and potentially could be even for generating electricity. I'm just arguing that we shouldn't lie to ourselves that this is carbon-free per the bill. We can work on finding ways to help this industry and deal with this waste, but let's not just classify something that it simply isn't.
All right, Representative Igo, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for a great discussion today, but I really want to thank my testifiers who came down, two of which are in a very busy time of the year right now, so to take time to come to St. Paul and testify on this behalf, I just thank you. And the committee members, those were two people that really know a lot about this, and I'm glad everyone paid attention and listened. So this bill today, you know, there's been kind of the back and forth about what is carbon-free and what isn't, and we shouldn't, quote, lie to ourselves. I think that if we're going to pick that mentality, if we're going to talk about things, let's make sure we use science for all things. Because from the testifiers I had today, from the science you can read, when trees are growing their whole life, they're sequestering carbon until the day we cut them and use them for the wood products we use in our everyday lives. What's left over, the residuals, could be used to help us have more affordable, reliable, and safe power. That carbon that would be emitted in that process would be less than those trees sequestered their entire lifespan. In fact, most of this you could actually consider if you bring out your old-fashioned abacus and follow where the carbon's going, you could actually say this is probably carbon negative, because maybe what's left over those residuals built the desk that's in front of me right now. It's going to sit here for another 50 years. And we're doing that every year when we harvest 1% of our forests and replant them, and that's why we have more forests than we ever have had in the state of Minnesota, because we're doing such a good job at replenishing them. So I think the comment that was made is, let's not lie to ourselves about what's carbon-free. You know, we had this discussion in committee 2 years ago, and we talked about solar and wind. Solar and wind takes over 17 to 20 years to offset the carbon it used to create it. We had that discussion, right? And if we want to pick and choose what science we follow to fit the narrative that we want, that's a problem when we're talking about policy for the entire state. That's a problem when we're talking about the policy for future generations. Because science isn't about picking and choosing, it's about following the facts and the figures. And this bill today is doing that. It's partnering with one of Minnesota's legacy industries, the fifth largest in the state, to make sure that when we have residuals, whether they're in greater Minnesota communities or right here in downtown St. Paul, we are creating markets to provide that affordable, safe, and reliable power. So if the carbon's going to be emitted anyway, at least it's not happening in a landfill. At least it's not being charged back to people and it's not being used for something. So this bill in front of us today is going to put us in step in the right direction and follow red states and follow blue states. In fact, you could look at this bill as a compromise. You have a Republican in front of you coming to work on the 2040 bill, realizing what you're trying to do here and trying to find a way to market this and work on it together so that all Minnesota prospers, So we have one Minnesota. So I'd encourage the committee's support today and hope we can continue having these good conversations, because these are the ways we have to think and we have to come together on if we want Minnesota to succeed and prosper and be a place for generations to come. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Igo renews his motion that House File 249 as amended be placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
The motion prevails. This motion passes, and the bill will be on its way to the general register. All right. Thank you, Representative Mecklen, or Representative Igo, Representative Mecklen, to your bill, House File 1311. Representative Mecklen moves that House File 1311 be placed in the general register. Representative Mecklen, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1311, yes, I'd like to move that if we're ready.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Mecklen, we've already moved your bill. You're
okay,
ready to rumble.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this has been a conversation we've had for a number of years and in different types of conversations, right, from coming from different approaches. And I think it's become a bigger issue now. 2 weeks before school started last year, the notification went out that we were in a max generation warning, and like those that I believe they're in curtail agreements, all receive a notice to shut things down, get off the grid, and it's often been a question as to what are we doing to address the lack of power at a peak demand, and why they seem to be happening more and more. So what this is basically lays out is a opportunity for the capacity that each baseload energy source is be factored into the calculation for reimbursement. So, and I brought a Mr. Orr with me, who has a presentation that'll get into the details. If you would, I would like to have Mr. Orr explain his packet, his PowerPoint, which we do not have digitally. So,
all right, thank you, Representative Mecklen. We have Isaac Orr. If you'd like to introduce yourself to the committee, and thank you, and get on with your presentation.
All right, thanks, Mr. Chair. My name is Isaac Orr. I'm the Vice President of Research at Always On Energy Research. I won't get into the details of my organization. You've got that for your benefit. So the benefits of House File 1311 are that they align the incentives of the utilities and their customers. And
Mr. Igo, if you just pause for 1 second. Just if members, Mr. Orr, if you want to just check in your folders, you have the presentation in there if you want to take a look. And it's also been emailed to you digitally. Mr. Orr.
So it promotes a reliable, low-cost electricity by giving utilities the incentives they need to build the power plants that provide the highest reliability value to the grid. Under House File 1311, utilities only profit from the reliable portion of the assets that they build, which saves customers billions of dollars in unnecessary expenses by changing the ways that utilities make corporate profits when they build new infrastructure. So that's a win-win for the Minnesota families and businesses that rely on that electricity. And we've already seen several energy-intensive businesses in the state leave. Northern Foundry left, citing high power prices. Gerdau was also a little bit more coy about their reasoning, but the high industrial electricity rates in the state of Minnesota are driving investment elsewhere. So just a 10,000-foot view, the state of the grid. The North American Electric Reliability Corporation says that the Mid-Continent Independent Systems Operator region, which is the regional power grid to which Minnesota belongs, is at the highest risk of rolling blackouts in the country. We could see blackouts as soon as this summer. And the reason for those, for that high risk, is that too many thermal generators are shutting down. Most of those are coal plants, and they are not being replaced with reliable capacity. So we also have surging electricity demand. We've got, what is it, Representative Mecklen, 4,000 megawatts of data centers potentially coming online?
Gigawatts.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sorry.
It's just 4 gigawatts.
Megawatts, yes. Our units, we'll get them straight, don't you worry. So we have surging demand growth, we have thermal retirements, we have long lines for interconnection queue for the wind, solar, and battery storage that is supposedly going to be replacing these reliable thermal assets. And also, we have to consider the fact that these wind, solar, and battery storage resources do not have the same reliability value to the grid that the thermal assets are providing. So as a result, less overall capacity, especially dispatchable capacity, is putting us in a precarious situation moving forward. And just kind of highlight this, if you look at this page, there was an 80-hour wind drought in 2020 from January 15th to February 14th. So there was an 80-hour period where wind in the entire Mid-Continent Independent Systems Operator region was operating below 10% of its potential capacity, and for 42 straight hours, it was below 1.5%. So that creates a very challenging environment in terms of reliability. The more you rely on wind, solar, battery storage, and you get away from the thermal resources that have historically kept the lights on for everyone. So this next graph shows, it's hard to see with black and white, but the straight line is nuclear generation. It's steady, eddy. It's the best generation resource you can have, especially if you're looking to decarbonize your electric grid. But coal and natural gas generation increased in order to meet surging demand during this period and to make up for the lack of wind generation. So the reliability value of power plants is assessed by MISO. They have something called an accreditation factor. And essentially it says, this is how reliable we think each generation type is going to be during periods of peak demand. And MISO uses these to determine whether there are enough reliable power plants on the system to keep the lights on during these periods of peak demand. So MISO is moving away from something called an effective load carrying capacity to something called direct loss of load. Essentially, they understood that the way that they had conceptualized reliability at that time or previously was not adequate for maintaining the reliable power plants on the system. So essentially what you have here is you have a table that shows that coal, natural gas, nuclear, oil, and run-of-river hydro have higher reliability values to the grid than wind and solar. And then this graph just shows that. So how only pay for what you get, House File 1311 would work, is the utilities, the rate of return, I guess I'll just get into that before I get into this. So if you look into this, I just want to quickly review how utilities make money. So companies like Xcel Energy or Minnesota Power, they're not private companies. They're not actual private companies. They're monopoly-approved utilities that are given their charter by the government. So because the customers have no choice but to purchase their power from the utilities, it's not fair to let them charge whatever they want for that power. So the cost of electricity is regulated by the government using a formula called the cost of service formula. And I'm not going to get crazy into the weeds here, but essentially what the cost of service formula says is a utility is allowed to charge enough for building new generation assets to recover the cost of that asset, plus a 5 to 10% profit whenever they build something new. So the more a utility company spends, the more they earn in profits for their shareholders. And there's another aspect of this formula called the depreciation. So essentially, every year an asset is in operation, the utility pays off, like, the mortgage on it. So essentially, every year that asset generates less profit for the utility, but it becomes a lower-cost generating asset for the ratepayers. So if you have a depreciated asset, say like Sherco or the Boswell plant, older plants, largely depreciated, producing some of the most reliable low-cost power in the state. So from the customer perspective, fully depreciated power plants are providing the highest value to the ratepayer, but from the utility's perspective, it's no longer providing earnings for their shareholders, so they want to shut it down as quickly as possible. That's the powerful financial incentive. So for only pay, essentially, if a utility wants to, say, replace a coal plant with, you know, 8,750 megawatts of wind, 2,085 megawatts of solar, 2,100 megawatts of batteries, or almost 4,000 megawatts of natural gas, that's a lot of new capacity to replace with their retiring. And, you know, some of that's going to account for load growth. But essentially, they're overbuilding the grid in order to make up for the lack of reliability of the assets that they're putting on the grid. And the customers are being asked to pay for that entire cost, which, in my opinion, isn't fair. So under only pay, so just using Xcel's latest IRP as an example, rather than Xcel earning $9.8 billion on the wind that they're going to be building over a 20-year period, they would only get the reliability value of that, which is 15% of that, so $1.5 billion. For solar, instead of 2.9, it would be $8 billion. Same with batteries, but natural gas, because it has a higher reliability value, they would get a higher return for their shareholders. So ultimately, the goal of this legislation is to incentivize the utility to build the most reliable, durable power plants. You know, a wind turbine lasts maybe 20 years, and Xcel is already repowering facilities after, you know, 12, 13 in order to re-qualify for production tax credits. So with OnlyPay, and I'm going to finish right here, so appreciate the committee's patience. So under OnlyPay, customers would save $12.3 billion on Xcel's latest resource plan, and that would save each of the average Xcel energy customer $9,000 over this 20-year period, which equates to $553 per year. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Orr. Is there any questions? All right. Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you remind me the motion for this bill, please?
The motion is to send the bill to the General Register.
Ms. Eng, could you confirm for me that there's a preliminary fiscal note that shows a cost for this bill?
Ms. Eng.
Mr. Chair, there's a fiscal note requested, and the PUC is named on the note with a preliminary cost, but the LBO hasn't signed off, so it hasn't been released.
Yes. But Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so given the cost that we can expect to come, I think this bill needs to be going to Ways and Means, Mr. Chair, and Representative Meckland. If the fiscal note comes in with the cost, can I get your commitment that you'll be sending this bill to Ways and Means?
Well, Representative Akam, any bill that would potentially spend, we would have to make that stop. So,
wonderful.
Absolutely.
Thank you for that. I appreciate that. Thank you for the clarification.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions for Representative or Mr. Orr before we, if you'd stick around just in case anything comes up, we'd appreciate it. Sounds good. Mr. Smith from the Department of Commerce, please come to the table, introduce yourself, and we'd love to hear from you.
Chair Swedzinski, members of the committee, my name is Sam Smith, and I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Department of Commerce. Thank you for the opportunity to provide comments on House File 1311. We are committed to ensuring that every Minnesotan has access to affordable, reliable, and clean electricity. The Department and the Public Utilities Commission already have a robust process for assessing electric system reliability and affordability of utility investments. We believe this bill is unnecessary given the existing processes. Adding additional regulatory hurdles around cost recovery will slow down the PUC process without providing new protections for Minnesota ratepayers. The Department of Commerce already reviews the cost of electric generation and transmission before recommending recovery in applicable riders and in rate cases. Historically, the Department has recommended several generation and/or transmission projects where cost recovery have been capped in riders or no return or capped in rate cases. House File 1311 focuses on the ability of a resource to provide energy at peak demand times. While this is one important aspect of resource choice, there are other considerations that impact resource selection, such as energy cost. Wind and solar resources are often chosen because they provide low-cost energy to the system and provide significant benefit to ratepayers. For transmission investments, peak demand is not the only factor. In some cases, transmission is necessary to reduce resource curtailment, which similarly increases the availability of low-cost energy from resources like wind and generation. Finally, we believe Section 2 is also unnecessary because utilities already provide robust reliability analysis in their integrated resource plans, which is where retirement decisions are addressed. IRPs are a comprehensive process with modeling for multiple stakeholders to carefully study sensitivities to load, growth, resource availability, and other uncertainties. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Smith. Are there any questions? Representative Frazier, did you have a, no? No, okay, all right. Vita Knantz. I butchered the heck out of that one. So if you would please introduce yourself so we can, I have one of those last names, too, so I've known people for quite a long time.
By the third time you hear me, you'll get it down.
Sounds good. Sounds good. Thank you. All right. If you'd introduce
Chair
yourself
Swazinski
for ourselves, thank you.
And members of the Energy Committee, my name is Vita Konitz.
There we go.
And I'm here on behalf of the DFL Environmental Caucus. Our mission is to educate and mobilize the citizens of Minnesota to address the climate crisis and to protect, preserve, and restore the natural environment. We oppose this bill because, like the speaker we just heard from, we believe the additional requirements outlined in it are not needed and could prove harmful to increasing reliability and resistance in times of peak demand. This is not needed because Section 6 of the Carbon Free for 2040 bill passed in 2023 already provides off-ramps to ensure reliability and cost benefits to consumers. But unlike House File 1311, it also requires that the Commission consider the environmental costs and the impacts on environmental justice areas. House File 1311 would decrease the reliability and resistance of our grid in times of peak demand and have a negative impact and economic and health impacts. Professor Mark Jacobson of Stanford reports, and I sent you links to this committee, that if Minnesota were to transition all sectors, electricity, transportation, buildings, and industry, to 100% electricity powered by wind, water, and solar with backup storage, we would achieve efficiencies that together reduce our energy needs by 57%. Now, this is because when we use fossil fuels, we're generating heat to turn a turbine, right, to make steam, to generate. It's not as efficient. There are many, many examples of how this would be a more efficient process. There are also co-benefits. Transitioning Minnesota to 100% clean energy sources would also create 103,000 more long-term full-time jobs than lost, save lives, 608 lives from air pollution per year by 2050 in Minnesota alone, eliminate 110 tons of CO2 per year in Minnesota, reduce Minnesota's 2050 annual energy costs by 63.9%. Also reducing energy, health, and climate costs by 85%. So, members of the committee, I urge you to reject House File 1311. The results will be cheaper electricity, a stable grid, and a healthy environment for all Minnesotans. I thank you.
Thank you. Is there any questions at all? Thank you, Mayor Konitz. Thank you very much. All right. We have Sarah Montalbano from the Center of the American Experiment on Zoom. If you'd want to unmute yourself and introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair Swazinski. Members of the Energy Finance and Policy Committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Montalbano. I am testifying on behalf of Center of the American Experiment. American Experiment is a 501c3 nonprofit public policy organization operating in Minnesota and North Dakota, and one of the largest grassroots organizations in the state. I'm testifying regarding the ability of utilities to earn a profit on unreliable assets. Skyrocketing energy costs have reminded Minnesotans of the importance of reliable, affordable energy. Vertically integrated monopoly utilities can recover the full cost of an asset with an additional 5 to 10% rate of return, regardless of whether the asset contributes to or detracts from grid reliability. Power plants using coal, nuclear, and natural gas tend to have high and steady capacity values, while wind and solar generate electricity intermittently, with lower capacity factors depending on the amount of wind and solar capacity currently present, as well as seasonal conditions. Despite wind and solar generating electricity less often than coal, nuclear, and natural gas, utilities still recover the full cost of their assets and earn a profit. American Experiment believes that ratepayers should get what you pay for. Under House File 1311, utilities would only be able to profit from the reliable portion of an asset. This would not prevent any company from building more wind and solar resources, but it would protect ratepayers from being billed for billions of dollars for assets that fail to generate reliable electricity. House File 1311 also requires a public utility seeking to reduce the capacity of or retire an asset to demonstrate that the system would still be able to meet electricity demand. In conclusion, legislation like House File 1311 would better align the incentives of utilities with their customers by encouraging utilities to build reliable assets, ensuring customers get the best value for their dollars, and that utilities are building the dispatchable power plants needed to deliver power during periods of peak demand and avert blackouts. Thank you all for your consideration and your dedication to affordable energy for Minnesota families.
Questions? Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Mekland. I think your testifiers did a good job of telling us why it's, you know, reliability is really important. But I come back to our testifier from the Department of Commerce. You know, he was saying, laying out how our current IRPs are decided and that process that it goes through, that we take into account reliability. So can you help me understand why do we need this bill?
Representative Beckland,
Mr. Thank Orr. You, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Jones. It in part, I've watched personally my I've implemented as much energy efficiency as I can, and yet my power bills continue to rise. And at a rate that I find is quite amazing. I'm hearing more and more about these max generation warnings. We've Representative Akam and I had the privilege of touring a relatively small data center on Friday, which was quite fascinating. However, we are going to have a significant power, a new demand coming at us soon. And whether it's in this state or the neighboring states, we kind of all share the same power, and particularly in MISO. This stems from trying to protect the ratepayer. And as the young lady just testified, Sarah, this doesn't prevent them from investing into wind or solar. It simply rewards them at the same capacity of what each generation device is producing. We're going to probably this year hear more and more conversation about SMRs and or nuclear moratoriums, and maybe we should be looking at that. But at this point, it's to reward the utility for investing in the most reliable source of energy is the point of it.
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that, Representative Mekland. So it sounds like the biggest concern is rate increases, the changing of our rates. And so I'm wondering if really what we need to be doing is trying to understand what is causing those rates instead of making an assumption about them. So I would love to talk about that more so we can really make sure that we're driving and diving in on the thing that is really the core issue. And I'd love to have further conversations about that offline.
Representative Mekland?
Was there a question in there, Mr. Chair?
Sounds good.
Okay.
Right. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about, and thank you, Representative Mekland, for bringing this forward. How many other states are using this model?
Representative Mekland or Mr. Orr?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Orr just informed me that it's proposed in 5 other states currently.
Representative Hollins.
Proposed in or is currently being used in?
Proposed.
Proposed.
Representative Mekland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Proposing. Okay. Representative Hollins.
Sorry, we're keeping you on your toes.
We're good. We're doing great.
Okay. I am also curious why we would, this seems relatively similar to the PUC process, which does look at reliability and affordability, and I'm wondering why we would supersede that PUC process and go with this tactic.
Representative Mekland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hollins, I don't know that I would really see it as a huge cumbersome task for the PUC. It's basically taking everything they figure out and multiplying at the end of it. This is what the investment was, and now you're going to multiply it by, as in this chart, by whatever it is actually producing, and perhaps whether that is determined by the PUC or MISO. I believe when MISO testified, was it last week or before, they talk about how they, when they look at different assets, what they give them for a rate as far as how much they're going to give it of its nameplate. So they factor that into the calculation, which is exactly what this would do. So if you're looking at the compensation rate on a $1 billion investment, instead of, if you're just going to use the easy numbers, if it was 10%, if this product only produces at 5% of the time, then they only get 5% of the 10%. It's a simple one more calculator move.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it feels to me like this is putting the thumb on the scale in favor of more traditional energy sources and non-renewable energy sources. And at the risk of, I'm going to try my best not to go on to a rant, but the whole reason that I am here in this committee and in the legislature is because of the threat of climate change. And I don't want to see something that is putting the thumb on the scale in favor of coal. I am distressed by it, not for myself, but for my children and the world that they are going to have to live in the future. I believe that it is my responsibility as a mother to be working hard to create a world where they can thrive and have the same experiences that I did as a child. And so I don't want to say disappointed because that's so patronizing sounding. I don't want to feel like that. I absolutely could not support a proposal that is going to significantly impact how those decisions are being made in favor of something that we know is destroying our climate and putting our health and our livelihoods at risk. And so I'm going to have to oppose this. What I wish we could talk about as far as ratepayers and what they are paying is compensation for CEOs of these major utilities. I don't want to throw out particular examples, but $21 million pay for a particular CEO of a utility, I think, is a bit extravagant. And I wish we could address that in lieu of this conversation around whether or not we should be looking at renewables or coal plants. And there was no question in there.
Thank you, Representative Hollins. I kind of picked that one up, so thank you. All right, Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was training you with the...
You did great. Question. Thank you very much.
Representative Mekland, actually, what I would like to do is, I think Xcel is here. I would like to ask them to come up with a question for them. And I am...
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sort of struggling with the Representative Jones' approach of the problem we're trying to solve here. But I did notice something, I think it was about a week or so ago, that Xcel made an announcement that I believe your plan is now to hit the goals of the 2040 law by 2035. Is that correct?
The gentleman from Xcel, if you could be kind enough to introduce yourself to the committee. And
thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Kraft.
Your name.
Thank you. I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. I might quibble with your description of it as the plan. The plan is the plan that we've laid out in our resource plan. Our estimate is that it will get us to the goal by 2035, so about 5 years earlier.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Evans, when you go before the Public Utilities Commission, do you all ever talk about reliability and cost effectiveness? Isn't that part of what you have to work through with them to come out with a plan that meets those guidelines?
Representative Rick.
Thank you.
Evans. Mr. Evans from Xcel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kraft, a resource plan looks at cost, reliability, carbon-free or clean energy and safety. Those are the main ones. There may be others that work in, but when we do resource planning, those are the, and frankly, when we do rate cases, when we do certificates of need, all of the processes that we go in front of the PUC for, look at all of those things and try to balance those factors in a way that is in the best interests of the state of Minnesota and consistent with Minnesota law. I could actually tell you that if you start at line 1.4 of the bill and read the rest of that first section, that pretty much describes exactly what we do at the PUC today, and doesn't, as far as I can tell, change it in any way.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Orr, in his presentation, talked about how it is utilities have an incentive to close fully depreciated assets as rapidly as possible so you can invest in other things. Not commenting on whether that incentive is right or not, but could you close an asset like that without approval from the PUC?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kraft, no, we could not. Okay. Well, we could, but it would jeopardize our ability to recover costs on replacement assets.
Representative Kraft.
Yeah. So thank you, Mr. Chair. So thank you very much, Mr. Evans. So my colleagues have stated some of my points as well, but I just fail to see that this bill is necessary. We're progressing in an effective way in this state. So I would encourage strongly a no vote on this.
Representative Jones.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is for Representative Mecklen. Jumping off of what Mr. Evans just talked about, how there's, you know, those four kind of criteria that you use when you're analyzing things to submit your IRP. So safety being a really big part of that. So I guess my question is, should reliability be more important than safety? Right now we have them all even in their assessment. Why should reliability be more important than safety?
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the whole direction of this is to focus not only on reliability, but the other key factor, which is affordability. It was brought up in our committee 2 weeks ago, maybe 1 week ago, that it's a situation looking, or however you worded it, Representative Hollins, the thing looking for a problem or something. But because nobody's considering hydro, nobody's considering nuclear because they can't. This is going after that whole same issue, that there are so many things that are carbon free, that are very safe, but that are not on the table, but yet we're incentivizing, or it's being incentivized equally no matter the output, and the output is my concern for the reliability for those that are on life support in a hospital or a refrigerated warehousing where we have goods stored, as well as many, many other things. And of course, everybody's feeling the effects of the continuous cost increases that Xcel and others keep going back to the PUC asking for. Luckily, the PUC has not given them their full request and ask as of the last two or three times they've asked.
Representative Jones.
Yeah, thank you for that. So it seems like safety is important to you, and I agree that reliability is important because of we need to be able to keep the lights on in our hospitals and all the machines and all those types of things. And we need the safety components of the power plants that we have to be in consideration. So I think it's really important, as I think Mr. Evans, kind of stated, our process kind of already has all these things that we need as a part of it. And I don't think we should be putting the thumb on the scale for one of those four.
All right. Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the conversation. I really appreciate Representative Kraft bringing Mr. Evans up. I think the example of Xcel Energy potentially meeting its 2040 goals by 2035, while under the regulation of our Public Utility Commission, with an existing process that looks at reliability, affordability, safety, as well as reducing carbon, is really demonstration that this is a solution looking for a problem. I was making fun of your statement earlier, but no, I didn't. I don't really mean that. I just mean that what we're doing is working, especially for utilities like Xcel. We need to help other utilities achieve that same kind of outcomes, and so. Because of the redundancy aspect of this to our existing process, I would encourage our members to vote no on the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Akam. Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make a clarification that we are...
My apologies. Excuse me. Can we have a roll call, please?
Yes, you may.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a correction, we are, the motion is to move this to Ways and Means.
Yes, Representative Mecklen, we will amend your motion to send House File 1311 to Ways and Means. You have any final statements you'd like to make on your bill?
This actually, the solution this is to protect the ratepayer, because it's something that everybody needs and has needed for several years now. So that is my motion. Thank you.
All right. Representative Mecklen renews his motion that House File 1311 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means, and a roll call being requested. Let's take the roll.
Chair Swidzinski.
Aye.
Vice Chair Murphy.
Aye.
Lead Acom.
No.
Representative Kraft.
No.
Representative Anderson.
Anderson, aye.
Representative Baker.
Yes.
Representative Carroll.
No.
Representative Frazier.
No.
Representative Hollins.
No.
Representative Igo.
Yes.
Representative Jones.
No.
Representative Mahmoud.
No.
Representative Mecklen.
Yes.
Representative Sexton.
Yes.
Representative Weiner.
Yes.
There being 8 ayes and 7 nays, the motion passes and the bill is on its way to Ways and Means. Members, our next meeting will be on Thursday, February 27th. This meeting is adjourned.